Hi, Marcus Fernandez here from the Center for Homeopathic Education, or CHE. The following episode is one of the incredible lectures our students have access to, and we wanted to share this content with you free of charge to give you a taste of what it's like to study with CHE. This lecture is on ancestral trauma by the world-renowned homeopath, author, and teacher, Colin Griffith. If you enjoy the lecture and you're interested in studying homeopathy with some of the best teachers in homeopathy today, then get in touch as our next intake is in January 2024. Contact us at www.chehomeopathy.com for more information.
Okay, so this is one of my favourite lectures because it's so abstruse, it's so peculiar, and it seems so unmedical. But for me, it's become something of a mission. Ancestral trauma, I think, is a hugely important part of homeopathy because so often it's a block to cure. And so often the patient doesn't know to tell you anything about it. So I want to talk about the effects of ancestral trauma and how they're not usually recognized for what they are straight away. At first, it's common perhaps to see that indicated remedies fail to work or do not complete more than a partial healing. If the use of nosodes, commonly prescribed to complete the action of constitutional remedies that have failed, also proved to be unsatisfactory in some way, and if there are no indications for any remedy that might fit the never been well since description as a block to cure, then it's possible that the underlying problem that is holding up progress may be ancestral trauma. For whatever you might hear in the next 2 hours, I would like to emphasize that despite the maverick things I'm going to tell you, I still remain at core a Hahnemannian. I love what Hahnemann did. I love what his homeopathic ancestors did. I'm thinking of James Clark, and I'm thinking of James Compton Burnett. These were extraordinary characters, and they were Hahnemannian at core, despite the fact that they didn't always follow the rules. I quite like that. So the term ancestral trauma covers different scenarios. They may be basically divided into two types. So there is trauma that is visited on a patient directly through malign treatment, bad treatment by a forebear on the patient, or perhaps by a parent on a patient. And this amounts, of course, to abuse perpetrated by one generation directly on another. The other form is the trauma that has happened in the life of an ancestor that has had reverberations down the family line. In other words, the patient today in front of you may not have been abused, but may carry in some way the memory of a forebear who suffered really badly and never found a resolution for their suffering. Both of these are signs that a historical malignant energy, once initiated by trauma, is still active and seeking resolution, even if many years have elapsed from its inception. This is a really important thing. We are so familiar with events in a patient's life that have happened that have caused untold misery in that patient's life. But anything that is sufficiently significant in terms of the effects of an energy, however long it may have been established, even from previous generations, that energy still requires resolution. And it's very common for patients that might be in front of you to carry the memory of an unresolved trauma. And this is part of the search for reasons why patients don't get better, despite all the good signs that you know may be there. So patients might be aware of the ancestral implications of the story that they have to tell, or they may be completely unaware, and they only come to realize gradually through the effects of treatment. This latter case may be illustrated by those cases that seem to go on for a very long time, with only partial relief here and there, from well-chosen and well-indicated remedies. But it leaves you, the practitioner, feeling as though you're failing the patient. I've heard many practitioners say, oh, I'm such a rubbish homeopath. And actually, it's not that the practitioner is rubbish. It's simply that there's something still to be found in the patient's story. So practitioners often are equally ignorant of the role of negative ancestral energy until perhaps a chance reference to a forebear, to an ancestor, may alert them to something previously hidden or secret or unnoticed. I would underline that word secret, because many situations from the past are secret, sometimes even taboo. And this hidden quality is very important, because patients sometimes are very reluctant to go anywhere near any of this stuff. And I think I've lost a good deal of patience from perhaps expecting them to respond to remedies that are based on their past trauma. I fully confess that perhaps my mission to find ancestral trauma can sometimes be overbearing. So I have to learn to hold back quite a lot of the time, even if it means that I have to spend 2, 3, 4 years with patients before we begin to, so to speak, crack open the hard nut shell of the case. So the presence of multiple layers, I think we all know about layers cases, but the presence of multiple layers of problems is often a guiding sign that ancestral energy may be involved. So there are often telltale signs that were there from the beginning, but you didn't recognize them. Any case that is syphilitic, very heavily syphilitic, is likely to harbor ancestral problems. There's a problem in that, because syphilitic problems are not always so easy to spot. After all, syphilis does not want to be seen. As we know, it's the great disguiser, and it will cause all sorts of grief without announcing itself. Indeed, some patients who obviously need their syphilitic miasmatic side to be treated will often stop treatment at that point. They don't want to go anywhere near it. I've seen that so much, how very syphilitically infused patients simply won't go there. Indeed, I would say early on in my practice, I had several, if not quite a few patients whom I did spot as being quite syphilitic. And I had the feeling, and this is entirely personal, I had the feeling that they were there to test me, that they were there to test me within homeopathy. They were there to prove homeopathy didn't work. And I found that very peculiar, until I realized more about the syphilitic miasm. And we're going to talk about the syphilitic miasm this evening, because I don't think we can do this ancestral work without knowing about syphilis and its influences. Perhaps I would rather call it syphilism, because syphilis is the disease, the acute disease. The miasm is, you know, we call it syphilinum, the remedy, that is the syphilitic miasm, but actually syphilism is the state of humanity that is best exemplified by what looks like self-destructive tendencies. But that's such a simplistic way of looking at it. So we'll come back to that in a minute. So any case where patients have a history of conflict with a particular ancestor, maybe a parent or grandparent, that's a theme that comes up a lot. And if you have patients who have got this problem, that they keep on talking about a father or a mother or a grandmother or a grandmother, grandfather, who's a particular problem to them, then you need to be listening really carefully, because something is there in the past. And that can be very easily exemplified by a patient who absolutely won't see, absolutely will not have anything to do with that particular person. Very common. This could be obviously expressed as implacable hatred, or perhaps fear of that ancestor, or even quite the reverse, persistent dutifulness. Dutifulness is a state of being in your patient, which is often the result of a syphilitic energy, because dutifulness is what syphilis likes, syphilism, it likes it, because it holds the person there in their in the grip. It's quite powerful. Sometimes there is an event that the patient tells you about that highlights this ancestral problem. Perhaps it is a parent's terminal illness, or a parent dying, or a parent slipping into dementia. Perhaps it's a legal case that evokes old emotional responses. Perhaps it's a personal sudden realization of aging in the patient in front of you, and the feeling, oh my goodness, I haven't got enough time to accomplish things. I haven't got enough time to accomplish healing. And if perhaps the patient exhibits behavior towards their own children that they have complained of from their parents, they may be unconsciously revealing old patterns of negativity. So you can see the field of investigation is really broad and very deep, and it can be very distressing. It is often very emotional. It may be also that a patient who is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder may be expressing trauma from a past, one of their pasts or the past, or it could be from an ancestor. So PTSD can be a problem of today, never been well since, being blown up by a bomb, or it may be from before. A lot of people, it really surprised me to come across this when I first started, a lot of people quite frankly tell you, may take them a little time to do this, but they frankly tell you that they remember their past lives. And when I first started homeopathy, I'd never even thought about it. However, what is actually going on is that there is a mirroring today of another time. And I don't think we should be surprised by this, because mirroring of a past time today is simply producing a like. It's a cliche, isn't it? Like cures like, but like finds like. Like looks like. And it exists in all forms of energy. So the discovery in your patient with whom you're struggling of mirroring from a past time becomes a very important source of new investigation. What we're looking for is what mimics what. And that mimicking, that looking for likeness, is a beginning to unravel ancestral energy in order to find this resolution. The energy of that trauma-inducing time, in other words, has continued from the past into the present and is still looking for healing. That's the point. It's still looking for healing. Now, whatever trauma there may be buried in the past, as I have said before, it is more than likely to have syphilitic implications. And we need to look at syphilis a bit more closely in order to see how we can use that information. So the core of syphilis, the miasm's positive attribute, is, of course, the discovery or the bringing to light of anything that requires healing. I like to think of syphilis or syphilism as being a potential phoenix moment. It's about burning away what is no longer important or necessary and revealing what needs the most healing and help and light, so that the patient is able to make sense of what they've been carrying. And of course, sometimes they have no idea what they have been carrying. There are times, I will just put this in because it's important, there are times when the darkness that the patient has been carrying is so heavy, it's such a burden, the effort of removing that burden would be so great, they are so fearful that they're not going to do it. And what's more, they will punish you, the practitioner, for even helping them to do it. It's very significant. I will give you an example of that. This is off the cuff. It's just something I remembered from this morning. I go to a personal trainer, and this personal trainer said to me this morning how he was a bit nonplussed because he'd had a client who'd come to see him, and she was a young woman who just had a baby about 9 months ago, and she weighed 18 stone, and she felt that she wanted to get into shape. And she came to see him, I think, 3 times, and on each occasion, before he even said a word, she burst into tears. So he got her to do some exercises, and she was perfectly fit and capable of doing the exercises, but their session kept on being broken down by her tearfulness. And eventually he said, what do you think is causing this? And why is it coming up now when we're doing exercises? And she told him a long story. And she said that her husband was very controlling, and he was on drugs, hallucinogenic, recreational drugs, and that he self-harmed. And she herself didn't know what to do about any of this. And this was, she said, oh, it's my sob story. She tried to make light of it. So he suggested perhaps that he might help her by suggesting that she went for some sort of counselling. That's all he said. Perhaps some counselling would help. And she left and sent him a blistering email saying in the email that he had absolutely no right to try and help her, that he was unprofessional, and that he had no business in talking to her in the fashion that he had. And he was quite nonplussed. This is a situation in which the very syphilitic energy within the family, exemplified by the husband's behavior, seems to be spreading. It spreads out. And the woman was blaming the sports trainer for interfering. But this is typical of syphilitic energy that does not want to be helped. It doesn't mean so that it can't be, but she certainly didn't want it then. So we're always looking at this syphilis energy as being something terrible. And it can be. Just look at the life of Henry VIII. That's pretty terrible. But actually, we need to look at the other side of the coin. That is that syphilism is incredibly positive if we can turn the patient towards, it's a bit cliche, but turn the patient towards healing and light. So this whole business of dissolution and destruction is reversed so that we can make something positive of it. So understanding that the syphilitic miasm has this positive side of burning away what is no longer viable, what is destructive, but creating something positive, purposeful, that makes it very, very useful to us. And of course, what we do about that is we use the remedy syphilinum judiciously when it's either indicated in its own right or when it's necessary to use it to underpin, if you like. That was Martin Miles's term. He used to say that nosodes underpin what your remedies, your constitutional remedies are effecting. And I like that idea. It's a support. It's like scaffolding on your building. And he used nosodes an enormous amount. I mean, he would use them all the time. Every day he would prescribe nosodes to people in order to support what they were trying to achieve. And syphilinum was, no, he wasn't short on that one. And he would use every potency available, including LM, and he would use it very judiciously when it meant that the patient was struggling with something that was potentially destructive of their positive, creative, purposeful energy. I don't know about you, but I will confess right now that I do my job because I really, really like knowing that people are becoming creative. They're becoming purposeful. I'm not so interested, maybe this is a confession, maybe it's not. I'm not so interested in the pathology, except as being illustrative of a person's place in their general circumstance. So sooner or later in ancestral trauma prescribing, sifalinum will come up. But though it does appear on its own as a support remedy, it often appears as a member of what we call triad remedies. Now, here we get a bit maverick, and you may not like what I'm going to say because it seems to turn everything on its head. I know some of you are quite happy using combination remedies. Some of you would not use them at all, and that's fine. But I am going to tell you about triad remedies using sifalinum because they are immensely useful in undoing ancestral trauma. To use triad remedies in ancestral trauma, we have to understand another thing altogether, and that is the role of the thymus gland. Now, the thymus gland is a very important part of our endocrine system. And if you can see me on the screen, you can see that I will place my hand where your thymus gland is. It's just here. So it's just to the right at the top of your heart. And it looks something like a pair of pink sweet chili peppers. Very small, but it's incredibly important. And the thymus gland has a very physiological role to play. If you don't know this, bear with me because it's an important thing. So the thymus gland is necessary in our development, in our maturation process. And it is active. It is very active in the first 7 to 10 years of our lives. And what does it do? So it is a storehouse. It's a place that receives from your spleen all those very important T lymphocytes that you're going to need to fight any infections and so on and cancers later in your life. You need that thymus gland as a cupboard, if you like. It's a cupboard where you store T lymphocytes, but it's so much more than that. It's also a gland of maturation in the sense that when your androgens, when puberty starts, the androgens begin to tell the thymus gland to tone down its effects, its physiological effects. So by the time you're 7 to 10, depending on your speed of your maturation process, you should have a full complement of your T lymphocytes, and the thymus gland should have done its physiological work, but it shouldn't die. There was a time when doctors used to think, or medical scientists thought, that the thymus gland should just atrophy and disappear. Absolutely not. It remains, shall we say, medically dormant, but it still plays a fantastically important part in our lives because the thymus gland is also the gland which is the part of your body that most remembers trauma. Now, this business of tissue memory, I think, is vital. Anybody who suffers an accident, they can have the memory of that accident held in the tissues that were damaged, even if that's your left foot. People who've had serious emotional damage in their emotional hearts can find that that's impossible to hold in their hearts. So they delegate responsibility for these traumas to other organs. The most common organ to delegate difficult energy of trauma is the liver, because it can do it quite well. but you can also send the history of trauma to other parts as well. Your lungs, your kidneys, your adrenal glands, you can send them anywhere. Into your brain, it depends on a person's susceptibility. And it's really important for us to be able to read that. But the thymus gland holds the memory of ancestral trauma. And I didn't know this until one day, a patient of mine who was suffering really severely from Hodgkin's lymphoma and had a tumor on her neck that size, really big, size of a fist. I felt stuck in treating her. So I asked her to go and see a cranial osteopath whom I very highly respect. And I asked this osteopath to tell me what she felt by palpating this person's energy body. And I was sent back a report, which was absolutely fascinating. I won't go into all the details because it's irrelevant to this talk, except that at the bottom of the page of this osteopath letter was, I went into her thymus gland. It was very dark and I feel really ill now. And I realized that I should have asked her, I should have said to her, I knew that there was darkness in her thymus gland and that she should be careful. So that was very remiss of me. And I had to give remedies to the osteopath to help clear the darkness she felt that she'd pulled out of this girl. And the darkness was very, very heavy family karma. Her parents hated each other like poison. And the father had a family who every member of the family was ill with very syphilitic pathology. The father's two sisters lived in a house where there was no electricity, no hot water, and they both had ulcerated legs so badly that the whole of their legs from the knees down were covered in bandages of cabbage, because they had understood from their mother that cabbage drew out poison. So for several years, these two elderly aunts had managed their syphilitic ulcers running, pus running out of their legs with cabbage leaves. That is bizarre. The father's father had anal fissures and abscesses. You could put a fist through them. They were desperate and terrifying. So there's just a small sum. There's much more to that case than I can possibly go into now, but it gives you an idea that there was an ancestral department to her story. And indeed, we were able to help this girl a little longer. She did, in fact, die. But that was, I have to be very careful here. I felt that it was partly because the mother could not reconcile herself to her husband's, so my patient's father's family. And these two families hated each other like poison. And it was very distressing to see it. So this was a failed case. However, I learned a lot about the thymus gland. So the thymus gland is this repository. It's a library of trauma. It's like a black box on an aeroplane. So in an aeroplane's crash, you look for the black box and it'll tell you what's going on. And there's a remedy made from thymus gland. So thymus gland, the remedy, is huge. It is a polycrest. I would hesitate to say it's a constitutional remedy, but you might like to think of it like that. And it is one of the most difficult remedies to prescribe that I know, almost as difficult as Thuya. Anyway, thymus gland can act like a direction finder or a torch. It can act as one of a triad of remedies. It can act to send remedies that are homeopathic to trauma to that historical place. If you like, when you use thymus gland in a triad of remedies, and I'll come to explain what triads are in a moment. When you use thymus gland in a remedy, in a triad remedy, you are unlocking a door to a corridor, and you're sending that remedy down the corridor of this patient's history. in order to shed light. I don't think there's any better expression for that. It's in order to discover what is there lurking in the dark that's stopping the patient from making the most progress. So if you can imagine in your minds, I'm sorry, I'm not technologically brilliant enough to be able to do all this talk and have stuff on the screens to show you, diagrams and what have you. So you have to imagine that you have in front of you a triangle. And this triangle is your triad remedy. And on the base, it says thymus gland. So that's your first remedy. And because this is a looking for what is most destructive in this patient's life, one of the sides of your triangle is going to be sifalinum. So we have two sides of a triad remedy. Now, the third side is going to be your selection from indications, homeopathic, genuinely homeopathic indications on the trauma. Now, I'm just going to pause here because what this means is that sometimes the similimum is not here and now. Sometimes the similimum is in the past. It's somewhere else. Indeed, I've known occasions when the similimum in my patient in front of me is not in my patient. It's in another patient in the past. Weird, wacky, bizarre. I know that sounds, but I don't have any other explanation for it. I still hold on to my Hahnemannian principles as much as I can. But nevertheless, I hope Hahnemann is still smiling and telling me it's okay to do this. But this triad remedy is about creating a homeopathic mime, a homeopathic similarity to a past trauma that requires resolution. So one of the first remedies that I ever used with thymus gland and sifalinum was ayahuasca. Now, some people will want me to spell that because it's a funny name. So it's spelled A-Y-A-H-U-A-S-C-A, ayahuasca. This is a liana. It's a vine from the jungles of South America, and it's a hallucinogen. And if you see it in the wild, it's a long, twisty, ropey type of liana, which is very tough and woody, but it's used, I'm sure many of you will already know, that it's used for hallucinogenic properties so that you can go on journeys, psychic and hallucinogenic journeys of discovery. And if it were just that, I wouldn't be talking about it. Ayahuasca is an enormous remedy. Ayahuasca is a remedy that can have implications for a patient deep, deep, deep into the past, very deep into the past. And it is particularly associated with traumatic events that are to do with mothers, grandmothers, female lines. And it has been called the spiritual umbilicus. That sounds, I know, it sounds a bit pious, and I don't want it to become a cliche, but I think it tells you the way that we could think about ayahuasca in a triad form. So it is about connecting to traumatic events in the past that have an association with mothers or grandmothers or female lines generally to the patient in front of us. And there's much more to this remedy as well. If you don't know it, it's really worth your getting to know it well. I must use ayahuasca several times a month in my practice because it's so useful. It's for all sorts of things. It even is for the effects of physical trauma, where people have twists in their bodies because they've fallen over something. And it's very useful for that. So it's an acute remedy. It is also the chronic remedy of arsenicum album. I've used it when arsenicum has all the indicated symptoms there, doesn't do anything. So I give ayahuasca and the diarrhea and the vomiting clear up. So it's a very a big remedy, lots of connections. but it is also where there is problems, that where there are problems beyond birth, beyond the umbilicus. I have to say also that it is a remedy for never being well since being born, or never being well since lack of nurture or lack of connection with the mother. It's a remedy I use very often with people who are adopted, because ayahuasca is very connecting. I think in all the cases I've given ayahuasca where there have been adoptions, that the patient has been adopted, the patient has gone on to look for their birth mothers. It's quite remarkable. However, so thymus gland syphilion and ayahuasca is often indicated in cases where there has been a traumatic relationship with the mother who has never bonded well with the patient and who have may have been left somewhat in fear, certainly never feeling safe or secure. This can also be of value in patients who were adopted and were never connected with their adoptive families. So it gives you an idea of how to make a triad. So here I'd like you to, I should say that there are quite a lot of lists of remedies of thymus gland, syphilinum, and one other. And I don't want you to get stuck on those. I don't want you to think that they're the only remedies that, you know, just because somebody else has used them, that you ought to stick with that list. Everything I'm saying tonight is today is about your intuitive prescribing. It's about drawing on your intuition and your knowledge of the patient to invent. Yeah, I'll use that word, invent prescriptions for patients, because the energy between you and your patient calls for it. So don't get stuck on lists that someone else has given you. And just because I've said thymus gland, syphilinum, and ayahuasca, don't go and use that just because it's there. It needs to mean something. It needs to be homeopathic to the trauma that you're trying to deal with. So we have got various remedies. I've got a list of remedies that we can share with you, and all their different reasons for being there. They've all got thumbnail sketches. Okay, so if the trauma-inducing ancestor is still living, it is not unusual that the patient in front of you begins to show signs of real progress, but the parent or the grandparent, the antecedent that's still living, they start to show signs of their own distress. And this is where you might think, oh, that's not for me to do. I shouldn't be causing that. But I'm not in any judgment about that. But my take on this is, if the patient in front of me is struggling to find answers to their unresolved problems, then if it's been caused by an antecedent, if it's been caused by a forebear who's still alive, then my patient is colluding with the persistence of that syphilitic energy. And it is safer for my patients for that energy to be returned to where it came from. That gives the person from whom it came, who may not have been the cause of the problem in the first place, that might have been even further back, but it gives that person in the antecedent the chance to do their own journey. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't accept that responsibility. But anyway, it is as if these people, the person next in line behind the patient in front of you, now has their chance to deal with whatever has come up. And I have seen that many times, many times. One of the most common remedies that can be used to open up cases like this is Buddleia. And thymus gland, syphilinum, and Buddleia is possibly one of my most commonly used triad remedies. I should mention Buddleia as a remedy on its own first before continuing. If you don't know Buddleia, you should. It's a very, very important remedy. And I will give you a very brief title for this remedy, and it will help you remember it. It's the emotional bombsite. Now, Buddleia is a plant. It's a beautiful, it's sometimes called the butterfly bush, and it's a beautiful plant. It can grow to something like sometimes 15 feet, but it's a shrubby plant, and it grows anywhere that has been devastated. So literally, after a bomb has dropped, Buddleia is going to be one of the first plants to colonize that bomb site. I would ask you to think of that as like the patient in front of you who's suffered some trauma. Devastation, they don't know what to do about anything, and now your remedy is going to plant something there in order for something to grow. So Buddleia is a trauma remedy from anywhere in history. It could be 5 minutes ago, or it could be 50 years ago, or it could be 150 years ago. But it is one of the most useful agents to effect healing in those who carry trauma from a long time ago. So Buddleia, thymus gland, and cephalinum, I have used that in cases where there's been post-traumatic stress disorder. I can give you an example. I treat someone who would tell you, if she were in front of us all today, she would tell you, I prefer animals to people. That's such a common thing for a NAPMEA person to say. Now, this person, she treats horses, and she's quite brilliant at it. And she has an affinity for horses that's unparalleled. I mean, I meet lots of people who, because of living in a and working in a country district, I meet lots of people who have animals, particularly horses. And I know no one else but this woman who is has quite such an affinity for horses as she does. Amazing. And she is very articulate about talking about herself in terms of her trauma. And her trauma is severe, very, very severe. Her trauma is that, first of all, she believes that she was born to the wrong family. And of her family, she has 4 siblings, all of whom hate her, she believes. I'm not judging the siblings, but she says they hate her. Her mother hates her. The only person she ever got on with was her father, and he died when she was 11 years old. At the age of 22, she was involved in a car crash in which she died. Her expression, not mine. She said, I died. And she told me that the car crash ended up with her car having turned 3 times over, landing on its roof, and that she was in the car. And the first thing that she saw was from above the car, looking down, her own hand out of the window of the car, and the paramedics coming along and not even noticing that she was there. And it was only the smell of petrol that alerted them to the fact that they were to look inside the car, and they pulled her out just in time. She was taken to hospital. Then she woke up from her coma, and she remembered nothing except looking down on the scene of her apparent death. She went to see a homeopath, and I know this homeopath is absolutely brilliant practitioner, and she treated her extremely well. But the thing that was missing was something that I don't think my patient had ever said to anybody else, which was she felt that she had been a gypsy in a previous life, and that as a gypsy, she had been murdered. And I'm a curious kind of person and probably asked too many questions. And I said, well, how were you murdered? And she said, I was knifed to death. And she had her throat slit. And I just wrote this information down. I don't say I believe it. I don't say I disbelieve it. I just write it down in order to store information I don't know what to do with. It was interesting that she did go and see an astrologer. And the astrologer told her that in a previous life, she had been a gypsy and that she had been murdered. And my patient had never told her that at all. So I kind of, again, I wasn't sure what to do with this information. But the remedies that I was giving her only palliated. She needed pulsatilla. She needed arnica for various things. And I seem to remember also she did very well on calc carb, but not well enough. So eventually I chose to believe her story about the devastation of her family, the devastation of the car crash, the devastation of a previous murder, her own murder. So I gave her thymostan, cefalinum, and Budleia. And from that date on, she has been getting better and better and better. And when she needs pulsatilla, it works. When she needs arsenicum, it works. Before, it would palliate. Now it does the job. And very interestingly, she is extremely psychic. And she lives in a cottage, which she tells me with absolute, you know, in her mind, she's completely clear about this. She lives in a cottage that's haunted. And she's very, very irritated with the ghost. And I said, why? So she said, well, he's an old gentleman and he's in the corner of my room. And whenever I'm at home and asleep, he goes and takes my remedies out of the drawer. And she hears footsteps on the stairs and various other things. I have no idea what to do about that kind of situation. So I sent her to talk to a man who does know. And he described this old man, and he said that this old man was very sad. And I won't go into the whole story of it, but I decided to give my patient Winchelsea sea salt. Sea salt is very similar to natmure, and put it in a saucer in the corner of the room. And from that day onwards, she's never had any problem with the ghost. So I have some peculiar patients. I really do. But actually, so do all of us if we wait and we listen to what they have to say. So I would suggest using things like thymostan, cefalinum, and Budleia when you're stuck and the patient is very clearly suffering from a trauma they don't really know where the beginning and end of it is. It's a very good policy. And the expectation is that they come back with information that's much more clear about a single remedy. In other words, by going into the past, you're making the present clearer, and you're making a truly Hahnemannian similimum easier for them to cope with. I'm always trying to get my patients back to the simplest possible place in their lives. I'm always trying to get my patients back to a state where they can take calc carb or sulfur or silica or phosphorus. I'm always trying to get them back to soric states, because in sora, it may be slow, but it's steady. It may be dull and boring and routine, but it's a really healthy place to be. And it's also the beginning for them of a lot of creativity. So some of the other remedies that I would mention, they include Aeschylus Hippocastanum album. Now, you'll know Aeschylus as the chestnut. You'll know it as a remedy for piles, for pelvic floor pain, for people who are high livers, who've damaged their livers. But I would like you to think about Aeschylus Hippocastanum album, the white chestnut flower, just the flower. Now, this is a very, very useful remedy indeed, because it is like an ancestral Staphylis agria. And this remedy, countless times, countless patients who've suffered from sexual abuse, even hidden away in this corner of countryfied Sussex, they have thymostan, cefalinum, and white chestnut flower, and it begins to lift the trauma of ancestral physical sexual abuse. So rape, abuse of all sorts. And the consequence of this is often emotional shutdown. The person just doesn't want to know anything about sexuality very often. They don't want to know about their sacral chakras. That's the second chakra, which holds this energy. And they're very often not responsive to remedies except in acutes. I don't know if you have patients like this, but I often have patients who do absolutely nothing for me on constitutional remedies, but are brilliant on acute remedies. Ring up with a cold, fine, arsenicum works beautifully, but the constitutional remedies, nothing. So that's a sign for me that I need to delve a bit. So Aeschylus Hippocastanum album, we call it in this country, we call it white chestnut flower. It's available at the pharmacies. It's for the history of sexual abuse, where there's emotional shutdown. And I would go so far as to say, don't use Staphylococcus aureus in this situation. Because what happens with Staphylococcus aureus so often, wonderful remedy though it is, when the stress and trauma of that ancient abuse comes to light or begins to show itself, and you think, oh, I need to work with this. If you use Staphylococcus aureus, what it will do is it will bring up quantities of anger, righteous anger. I'm not complaining about that, but the anger is destructive. The anger can be such a power that the patient doesn't want to let go of it, and they like feeling this power that they didn't have before. And so they persist in a rather Staphylococcus aureus state. I've seen this a lot. And before I give Staphylococcus aureus for an old case of sexual abuse, I will always use white chestnut flower. Well, not quite always. There is an exception. And that is that there is a remedy made from red chestnut flower. There are two chestnut trees. One's red, one's white. So the red chestnut flower has a difference. And in the red chestnut flower, we still have the history of sexual abuse, but the patient is still interested in or even fascinated by sexuality and can't let go of whatever event has happened to the sacral center. So they are different, these two. They have many similarities because they're both chestnut trees, but the color is what makes your choice the real choice. So there's another remedy here called amethyst. This is the crystal amethyst. This is a very interesting remedy, and it's difficult to prescribe with your thymus gland and cipollinum. But what you'll see is a history of depression. And if you delve enough into this, what you'll find is that the depression is about, I've done all this before. I can't get off the hamster wheel. Life is just a perpetual cycle of the same old habitual actions and reactions, and I can't change it. So this is typically an amethyst situation, repetition of old habits. There's a despair, a real despair of being ever able to change anything for the better. Thwarted mission. And the patient may actually say to you, I'm not really what I always meant to become. I'm meant to be something else, but I can't find how to do it. So they keep on same old thing. Amethyst, very useful remedy in depression. You may even find that patient has a tendency to alcoholism. Another remedy which is worth knowing about is aquamarine, another crystal. This aquamarine it belongs to the beryl family. So it has associations with emerald, and it has an association with golden beryl. There are three types of beryl. And of course, the beryllium is a remedy as well. So aquamarine is the pale blue, the translucent blue of the deep Mediterranean south. A lovely, lovely color, lovely stone, but oh my goodness, the patient who needs aquamarine is not in a lovely state. Aquamarine carries the sense of the history of disaster, the history of despair, and how it has affected not just this person, but their family and humanity. Here is a person who is concerned about humanitarian issues. Here's a person who's concerned with everything to do with the life of the planet. And they feel so much. And if you're interested in astrology, you'll know this is quite Piscean. This is typical of a Pisces energy.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that lecture with Colin Griffith. He truly is an amazing teacher. And there's so much information in that lecture, you may find yourself going back and listening to it again and again and again. So if you like to study homeopathy, you feel that homeopathy is calling you, then apply today for our January 2024 intake at www.chehomeopathy.com.